Okay. Hello. Sorry. I'd like to, first of all, obviously thank the organisers for their invitation to allow me to speak at this conference. And so I'll start by establishing some notation. We have a subset of the natural numbers, and AN is the intersection onto N, and delta N is the density, size of AN over N, and the upper density, of course, is the limit as N goes to infinity. So in many questions in additive combinatorics, we're of course concerned with whether or not a set of positive upper density necessarily furnishes solutions to a system of one or more equations. So of course some of the most famous examples are this system here, which essentially describes arithmetic progressions of length k, and of course Samaredi's theorem says that you have solutions to that in a set of positive upper density. And then there's this one here, which says that you have k powers in a different set of positive upper density, and of course that's Sharkey's theorem. And the first of these is an example of a system consisting solely of linear equations. The second is an example of a system which is not purely linear, but the analysis is dominated by the linear component, because that's the component from which we're drawing variables from the set in which we're interested. So the system I'll be talking about is not purely linear, and the analysis is dominated by the higher degree components, because we're allowing the higher degree components to be taken from the set we're interested in. So the specific system in which we're interested is this one here. We have lambda 1 x1 to the j plus lambda 0 x2 to the j, and so on up to lambda s x to the lambda s xf to the j equals 0, where j goes from 1 to k. So it's a system of k equations, all with the same coefficients, all diagonal. And we suppose that s is sufficiently large in terms of k. I'll make precise what that means in a moment. And the coefficients are integers chosen so that they add up to 0, which ensures that the system is translation and dilation invariant. So obviously you can get solutions to a system like this if you set all of the variables equal to each other. So we consider solutions like that trivial. So what we're interested in, of course, are non-trivial solutions. So let's take the base case first. Suppose we have a linear equation and a quadratic equation, and AN and delta N are defined as before. So I'll be proving two results about this system. First of all, suppose we have at least 9 variables and a set that contains no non-trivial solutions to the system of equations 1, which I'll write on the chalkboard just so that we have it handy. So this is system 1. Then for n sufficiently large in terms of the lambda I, there's an absolute constant c greater than 0 such that delta n decays as a negative power of log log n. And we'll show in our proof of theorem 1 that we can take this positive constant to be 0.8 million, or 1/1.25 million. And suppose further that we have more than 9 variables again, then there's a constant k greater than 0 dependent at most on the coefficients, such that if the set AN is quadratically A-uniform, where the uniformity parameter is less than or equal to a constant multiple of the density raised to the power 80, then for n sufficiently large in terms of the coefficients, the number of solutions is at least the expected number, delta n to the s times n to the s minus 3. And, of course, quadratic A-uniformity here, the definition is essentially due to Gauss. It's not quite the same one as the one he uses in his proof of Samaredi's theorem, but we'll see in a moment that it is equivalent. So the overall structure of the proof is based on the proof of Roth's theorem as done by Roth and the proof of Samaredi's theorem as done by Professor Gauss. So the idea is that if we assume the set is sufficiently quadratically uniform, then we can show using the Hardy-Littlewood circle method that we have roughly the expected number of solutions. So that's what Theorem 2 says. But if we have a non-uniform set, then we show that we can use the concentration arguments developed in the proof of Samaredi's theorem to get the bound on delta n stated in Theorem 1. So before I delve into that, there is actually a quick and easy way in which you can see that a set furnishing no solutions to this system necessarily has zero upper density. So Furstenberg and Katznelson proved in 1978 that if you have a set of positive upper density and a finite configuration, then there exists a translation and dilation of that configuration that lies entirely within this set of positive upper density. So since the system we're working in is translation and dilation invariant, if you have any non-trivial solution and you have a set of positive upper density, then there's going to exist a translation and dilation of that non-trivial solution, which is also a solution to this system, and all the variables in which lie in the set A. The only trouble with this is that it doesn't lead to a reasonable explicit upper bound for the density of a solution preset. And of course, we can also use Samarodi's theorem directly by supposing that smallest largest coefficient taken over, largest value taken over all non-trivial solutions. So that means that if you have an arithmetic progression of length y, it contains a solution to this set. So we can just assume that the set A contains no arithmetic progressions of length y or longer. So this will give us the bounds log log n to the minus c, where c is 2 to the minus 2 to the y plus 9. Two disadvantages of that are that the exponent in this case depends on the coefficients, it's not an absolute bound, and it's also, unless y is very small, it's also a lot weaker than the bounds that we've claimed. It does pose one small advantage though, which is that instead of requiring that S be sufficiently large to guarantee that the circle method works, which is what governs the size of S in the proof of the theorem, we only need S to be large enough for there to be non-trivial solutions, which you can show essentially by inspection, requires that S be greater than or equal to K plus 2. So when K equals 2, for example, we need 4 variables. So first of all, we define some exponential sums. We have an exponential sum over the set AN and a dilation of that exponential factor by lambda I. We have an exponential sum over the whole interval 1N and another dilation. And then we multiply that by delta n, and again we have a dilation of that exponential factor. So by orthogonality, and of course this is the result at the foundation of the Hardy-Littlewood method, the number of solutions in a n to the s to this system of equations can be written as the integral of the product of these exponential sums fi over the unit square. But computing this integral directly is fairly complex, so instead what we do is we replace these factors fi by these factors vi and try to get a handle on the error involved in this approximation and determine what the approximation integral turns out to be. So if we define this approximation integral I to be the integral of the product of the gi's, which remember are the exponential sums over the entire interval 1n, and multiply that by delta n to the s, then the error involved is going to be the integral of the product of the vi's minus the product of the fi's over the unit square. So if we define e to be the difference between this multiple of the integral of the exponential sum, over the entire interval minus the exponential sum just over the set, then by the triangle inequality and this trivial inequality here, we have that the error involved is going to be bounded above by the supremum of this error here times this integral of this sum of s minus first powers of v and f. And by some fairly trivial observations, we notice that we can bound these respective sums above just by observing that v and f are both bounded above an absolute value by the size of the set, delta n times n. So if we remove all but eight of the factors, and then note that by the underlying Diophantine equations, the number of solutions in A is bounded above by the number of solutions over the entire interval, and here all we're saying is that the density is less than 1, then if we define J to be this moment integral G to the 8, then the error involved in the approximation is going to be the supremum of V minus F times the size of the set to the power s minus 9 times this moment integral j. So if we want a bound on n, we're going to need to know three things. We're going to need to know an upper bound on the size of the supremum of e, an upper bound on the size of j, and a lower bound on the size of I. So that's what the next couple of sections are devoted to. So supremum of E is where Gauss's notion of quadratic uniformity comes into play. So if we define E to be the balanced function of the set AN, then the sum, well, script E to be the balanced function, then this Roman E error sum is the sum of the balanced function of the sets times this exponential factor E of alpha 2x squared plus alpha 1x. So we can use Weyl differencing, or finding the Gauss norm, if you prefer to think of it that way, to essentially render the exponential factor irrelevant and only be interested in the degree of quadratic uniformity of the set. So first of all, if we define the first forward difference operator by fx times fx minus w conjugate, and then recursively define higher order difference operators to be just the first difference operator applied to the dth difference operator, then we can reimagine the definition of quadratic uniformity to say that that a set is quadratically A-uniform if this sum here is less than or equal to An to the fourth. So the difference between this and the definition used in the proof of Semmeri's theorem, of course, is that the sums there are over the integers mod n, and in the case of this system of equations, it's somewhat more natural to think in terms of the integers. But we define the innermost sum so that these eight quantities all lie in the interval 1n. So if you sort of fit all of the pieces together, you still get a sum which is equivalent to summing each of these variables over the integers mod n. So if we apply Weyl differencing three times, we get that e to the 8 is less than or equal to 2n to the fourth times this double sum here, which is the same as this double sum here. So if we assume that the set is quadratically A-uniform, then e to the 8 is going to be 2n to the fourth times 2n quantity to the fourth times an to the fourth, which of course is 16an to the 8. So if we take eighth roots of that, then we have that E is bounded above by 2a to the 1 eighth n. And this estimate is uniform in A, which is one of the advantages of reducing the exponential factor to 1 by applying Weyl differencing three times, or taking the Gauss U3 norm. So we've established that the error E is strictly less than 2a to the 1 eighth times n. The integrals J and I are somewhat more straightforward to estimate because we can just apply the Hardy-Littlewood circle method. So provided that we have at least 9 variables, and provided that we have local solubility, which is not difficult to show if you have at least 9 variables, then by applying the circle method, you can get that this moment integral, which describes the number of solutions to this system where we have the sums of 4 squares equal to the sums of 4 different squares, and the sums of the corresponding variables equal to the sums of the other variables, that integral is bounded above by n to the fifth, and the integral describing the number of solutions in 1ns to this system here is bounded above by a constant multiple of, bounded below rather, by a constant multiple of n to the s minus 3. So C and Gothic script S are positive constants, which again is something that results from our having local solubility. So we now have bounds on the supremum of E, the moment integral J, and the approximation integral I. So if we substitute that into the error expression which we obtained at the end of the third section, then we have that this multiple of delta n to the s, n to the s minus 3 minus the number of solutions n is less than 2a to the 1 eighth delta n to the s minus 9 n to the s minus 3. So if we assume that AN is quadratically A-uniform for A bounded above by CS delta N to the 10 over 4 all to the power 8, then if we go through some arithmetic manipulation, we see that indeed the number of solutions is bounded above by C times S times delta N to the S times N to the S minus 3. So we get the bounds that we said we did in Theorem 2 by taking this constant multiple of delta n to the 80 to be cs over 4 to the power 8. So if we suppose now that an furnishes no non-trivial solutions, then we must assume that it's not quadratically a uniform for these small values of a. And in his proof of Samaradi's theorem, Gowers of course shows that if the set is not quadratically a uniform for a given value of A, then we can find a proper arithmetic progression above a given size such that we have this density increment 2B to the 1/2, where B is 2 to the minus 32,010, A to the 30,000. So if we define some more variables K and C, then if AN is not quadratically a uniform for small a, then we can find a progression, a proper arithmetic progression, I should say, of cardinality N1, where N1 is greater than or equal to this expression here, and the density is greater than or equal to this expression here. So we have a density increment of 2 k to the 1/2 delta n to the c. So either we do this and we get a set which is sufficiently quadratically uniform viewed as a subset of the integers up to n1 such that we can apply the original argument, or we can apply the concentration argument again. And as in the proof of Samaradi's theorem, we can iterate this argument so that either eventually we get sufficient uniformity as to guarantee a non-trivial solution, or the density becomes 1. And if either of these happen before the set becomes too small for non-trivial solutions to be possible, then we necessarily have non-trivial solutions. So because we have this density increment of k to the 1/2 delta n to the c, we can apply it at most k to the minus 1/2 delta n to the minus c times, and by a bit of arithmetic manipulation, this means we have non-trivial solutions as long as log log n to the minus 1 over c is less than delta n. So if we have no non-trivial solutions, then this must be false, and we have that the density is bounded above by log log n to the minus 1 over c, and 1 over c is greater than 8 times 10 to the minus 7, because 8 times 10 to the minus 7 is 1 over 1.25 million. 1 over c is 1 over 1.2 million, so we get the bound stated in Theorem 1. So if we now consider a system of k polynomials for k greater than 2, so in other words, we're no longer assuming that k equals 2 in this system here, we can get analogous results subject to a few slightly different assumptions. So first of all, we have a different bound on the minimum number of variables required, which is dictated by the fact that in applying the Hardy-Littlewood method to a system like this, we need to use Vinogradov's mean value theorem, and this is the minimum number of variables required to establish the asymptotic. I believe the bound is due to Trevor Woolley sometime in the mid-1990s. And we define a non-singular solution, of course, to be what you would expect it to be. It's a solution to this system such that there's at least one set of k indices where the Jacobian associated to those indices is non-zero when evaluated at A. So in other words, not all of the Jacobians are zero at A. So if we suppose we have at least S0k variables and AS contains no non-trivial solutions to this system, and if we suppose that this system has non-singular solutions both over the reals and the p-adics for all rational primes p, then for n sufficiently large, there's a constant c dependence on k such that delta n is less than log log n to the minus c. And one can show in the proof of Theorem 3 that we can take c to be the same exponent that shows up in the proof of the general case of Samaradi's theorem, 2 to the minus 2 to the k plus 9. Then, of course, we can also get an analogous result on the number of solutions in the uniform case. If we have sufficient uniformity of degree k, where the uniformity parameter is a constant multiple of the density to the power 2 to the k plus 1 times S0 of k plus 2, then for sufficiently large n, we essentially have the expected number of solutions, delta n to the s times n to the s minus the sum of the numbers from 1 through k. And once again, we assume that we have non-singular solutions in both the reals and the p-adic numbers. And one disadvantage of the proof as it is currently now written is that it's not entirely obvious how to determine whether or not a given system possesses real or p-adic solutions, so we essentially say assume that it does, and this is the number of solutions that you obtain. So the overall structure of the proofs, which I won't be going through in depth, is essentially similar to that of the proofs of theorems 1 and 2. So once again, we show that if we have sufficient uniformity, you can use the circle method to show that you get the expected number of solutions in a set, and if it's not uniform, then we can show again that it's concentrated in a long arithmetic progression P, and we can iterate this process until either we have sufficient uniformity or the density becomes 1, and if those happen before, after the set becomes too small, then we get the bound stated in Theorem 3. So the differences, of course, are that this time we're assuming a uniformity of degree k, which again is essentially the same as the definition in the proof of Semmeretti's theorem, except that it's defined over the integers instead of the integers mod n. So again, we define the variable x to fall in this interval so that the translates by any sum of the wi necessarily lie in the interval 1n. And we can also apply the Vinogradov mean value theorem directly to estimate the analogues of the integrals j and I, but to show that the constants c and s that show up in estimating the integral I are positive, in other words, the constants that result in the singular integral and the singular series, we need to assume local solubility, and again, it's not entirely clear how we can remove that assumption at the moment, but it should be possible subject to suitable conditions on the number of variables and the number and the coefficients. So it's perhaps natural, once you have a system like this, to ask what happens if you're dealing with the primes. So I'm sure everyone here is familiar with this result. Green and Tao proved, well, they proved a couple of years ago, the result is still on its way into print, I'm told, that the primes contain arbitrarily long arithmetic progressions, and indeed any subset of positive upper density contains arithmetic progressions of arbitrary length. So this, coupled with the translation and dilation invariance of this system here, implies that it necessarily possesses non-trivial prime solutions, and in fact has non-trivial solutions in subsets of the primes of positive relative upper density, as long as we have enough variables for non-trivial solutions to be possible. But it doesn't necessarily yield a quantitative bound for delta n. So of course there is a quantitative bound for the three-term case, which Ben Green proved in 2004 and is now known as Roth's theorem in the primes. And the quantitative bound he obtained is log 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 n to the minus 1/2 plus epsilon. If you write it out in full, of course, it's log 5n over log 4n to the power 1/2, but you can absorb the log 5n into this epsilon here. So if you have a subset of the primes that obeys this density, then it necessarily contains three-term progressions. So certainly it's possible to show, using methods developed by Liu Kenghua, Ivan Vinogradov, and various other people during the latter half of the 20th century, that the number of solutions we expect to be furnished by a subset of the primes of relative density delta n has this form here. We have cs times delta n to the s times n to the s minus 3 over log n to the s, where c and s are positive constants. So in the case k equals 2, we require that s equals 9. So if we can render precise the notion of pseudo-randomness we need to get the expected number of solutions, and if we can quantify what happens if we don't have that degree of pseudo-randomness, then we can get a quantitative bound on the density in the prime case. But if that's possible at all, using only what's currently known, it's only possible in the case k equals 2, and the bound that we would get is probably something of the same form, log 4n to the minus c plus epsilon, where c is an absolute constant, and probably something considerably smaller than 1/2. So I'll close with a couple of possible future refinements of this result. So it's almost certain that you can remove the local solubility hypotheses for certain systems, again, subject to suitable conditions on the number of variables and the coefficients, although at the moment the only ways to work around this which I've devised require extremely large numbers of variables and somewhat arcane conditions on the coefficients, but it can be done. It would also be nice to reduce the minimum number of variables required. So of course the minimum number of variables is dictated by this minor arc integral over the k-dimensional unit square, where we're estimating the tth moment of this exponential sum here. And depending on the methods you use, you can get away with taking t to be a bit smaller. So it's possible in the case k equals 2 that one can apply the restriction theory developed by Jean Bourgain in his study of subsets of squares and used by Ben Green and Terry Tao in their work on linear equations in the primes to reduce the hypothesis that S is greater than or equal to 9 in the case K equals 2 to S is greater than 6. And finally, it should be possible, since we have a bound similar to the one obtained in Samaradi's theorem, to apply the same refinements that have been applied both to that and to Roth's theorem by, variously, Heath Brown, Samaradi, and Borghan to get a bound of log n to the minus c. And of course, as I'm sure most people in this room know, Green and Tao have already used such methods to refine Gower's bounds in the four-term case for Samaradi's theorem to delta n less than x of minus c to the root log n. So again, using only what is currently known, it's only going to be possible to do this in the case k equals 2, but it is certainly a possibility. So, thank you.